Mr. Trofimov, reel 3.
Well, this enabled me, now that I was in civilian clothes, to go into the town of Goron at night. But obviously I had to sneak round back streets and so on because of the curfew. Well, I managed to get quite close to two or three of the German positions that they were taking up with machine guns and various other equipment. And on the way back, on that very first night, I ran slap bang into a patrol. They were mainly very young soldiers, led by a young NCO. And I had to think very quickly, because of the curfew, you know, I shouldn't have been there. So I pretended to be drunk. And in fact, I leant against a wall and started retching. And to this day, I don't know why. They just went by. I think by then, you know, they were in retreat and the morale was very different. Had it been a month or two earlier, I think that would have been UP up for me, because I was carrying a 4.5 Colt in my pocket, which is quite a heavy pistol. And, you know, if they'd frisked me, they would have very quickly come across that. I then, there was another incident where I wanted to contact a gendarme who knew the area very well on the side of Goron where the Americans were likely to come from. And he knew the countryside very well, and I decided to risk it in daylight to go and contact him because time was getting short. And I set off to go and meet him. And suddenly, to my horror, as I came round a bend, there was a German regiment resting by the roadside. And there was no other way for it. I had to walk through this. And I had to, obviously, not show any panic. I put on a slight limp, because being a young one, they might have thought, why is he not in a labor camp? And I kept my head down and tried to look as a sort of useless young fellow. I had fortunately my beret right down on my head. And I was wearing very old clothes. And I walked through, and I could feel the sweat on the back of my shirt. I thought, everybody must see that I'm panicking. And I managed to get through to the other end, and I've never been so happy to see a wood and get into it. I really had to pull myself together for 3 or 4 minutes, because it was the most extraordinary feeling, being right amongst them, with no weapons, nothing, and in civilian clothes. Anyhow, I did eventually contact this chap, and he agreed to help me. And I think it was a day or so later, I continued at night checking on the German positions. And then word came through via the police. The gendarmes were wonderful. And of course, they could communicate from town to town by telephone. And word came through that the Germans were approaching Goron. Excuse me. So I sent a message via one of my other gendarme contacts to this gendarme that was going to help me. And he came out, and we set off across the fields using detours that he knew. And we eventually contacted an American advancing patrol unit. And when I went up to them, they thought I was some kind of crank, because I was in civilian clothes, and they didn't. It took me some time before I could convince them that I was, at the time, I was British captain. When they accepted my story, they said, "Well, we're not going any further. We're just a recce group, but we'll pass on any message you have back to HQ." And I gave them my code name, so that, because at HQ there were supposed to be SF liaison officers, special forces, the liaison officers. And I gave them all the information I could on the Germans, and I went back to await developments. And then I thought, well, if the recce group's so close, it's not going to be long before the main body comes, arrives. So I set off this time on my own and made contact with, I've got it down here, I think, with Colonel F. Oliver of 106 Cavalry Reconnaissance Squadron, whose instructions had been to attack Goron. It took me a little time again to establish who I was, and etc. And then he invited me to join them, and I said, "Well, look, if you're going to attack Goron, you're on the wrong road. There are quite a lot of German posts on both sides of the road," and I explained the German position. I said, if you follow me, we can go in by a side road and take the town without having to shell it." He said, "Well," which we did. And we encountered a certain amount of light machine gun fire and rifle fire, but nothing to get too upset about. And we got into the center of the town to see the Germans fleeing virtually. off towards Alençon. I then attached myself to one of the American officers to act as a sort of liaison, because there's an awful lot of things to sort out when a town is liberated. And I stayed with him for a couple of days, and then the Americans lent me a driver and a jeep. And they took me to HQ. And I gave a full report there of what was happening, and as far as I was able to, the likely movements of the Germans in the area. Having done that, in the meantime, I'd found out where my team were, the other members of the team were. They were at a place called Combourg. I headed off to Combourg, and...
Is this a village?
It's a town. It's a very nice town with a lovely chateau, very famous chateau and lake. And I rejoined them, and we moved then towards Saint-Malo. Now, at this time, the Germans were putting up tremendous resistance in some of the islands off Saint-Malo. And they were in little pockets in concrete gun posts and such like, all over the area. Well, the Americans didn't have time to sort all these little fringe things. And that's where resistance came in very handy. So by then we'd got volunteers from people who'd they certainly weren't there when we were behind the lines, but suddenly everybody was in the resistance, which was rather laughable. But we did recruit quite a few people, and my French partner went off and took one sector. And I moved into Saint-Malo, and I met a Capitaine Dubois. Always remembered him. charming fellow who was wounded, and he was head of the gendarmerie there. And their problem was that in the ramparts of Saint-Malo, there were German snipers, and it was very difficult to flush them out. So I spent several days there, partly with resistance, and I got one or two Americans allocated to me, and we flushed out as many of these snipers as we could. And once that was over, and the Germans capitulated in the Ile de Césambre, that was the end of our activities.
How keen were these German snipers to fight on?
Some of them were. They seemed to have a death wish. I mean, the Ile de Césambre was of course a different story. They were on this little island and they had gun posts and they were firing from it. And it took 3 weeks to flush them out. I mean, the Americans dropped everything on top of them, and eventually they dropped oil bombs onto them and then incinerated it. And they came out, they had supplies that would have lasted for months. They could have lived there for, I think, just about another 6 months or so.
And the individual snipers whom you were dealing with?
Well, not just me, there were other resistance people involved. They were gradually flushed out. Some of them gave themselves up, others were killed.
Can you describe any incidents?
Not particularly. You don't see a sniper, except suddenly a gun that appears. And there was one incident where there was a sniper in the window of quite a tall building, and a few of us went round on the ramparts. And we managed to get in a position where we could fire at this window opening. But very difficult. We'd see a helmet appear. And we kept on firing. And eventually things went quiet. And we were able to get almost opposite. But it was still too far to hurl a grenade. And we might have done damage to something else. So eventually we waited quite a while, but nothing further happened. And some resistance people were operating further down the ramparts, signaled that he'd been killed. So that was one incident, but no particular ones other than...
How much damage was done in Saint-Malo?
Oh, a lot. The town was badly damaged. The buildings were in a very poor state, bombed and gutted. But one has to say this: if you go back now, it's incredible how they've rebuilt it almost as it was. All its old charm is there. But at the time, it was just a mass of ruins.
Was there at this time a hunt for collaborators?
Oh, yes. I rather gloated over it. Skipped over it. But when I joined the American officer in Goron, one of the tasks we had to sort out the claims made by various people about collaborators. And females had their hair cut off, and people were being brought out onto the street and would have been shot, on the spot. And so we had to establish some sort of law and order in each place. And the Americans were very good at it, and so were our own people. They had administrators who came in and until the gendarmerie took control. But yes, there was a tremendous witch hunt immediately afterwards. But equally, we found that there were vast numbers of people suddenly going around with armbands on, saying that they were members of the resistance. Well, where had they been when we were there? This was a post-war resistance set up. Some of them may have been fairly genuine, but a lot of them weren't. And again, we had to take a lot of their claims with a pinch of salt.
So it was just a question of coming out on the winning side?
Yes.
What happened to you next?
Oh, well, then we got orders via the radio to report back to base. I turned up at HQ, I think it was near Avranches, and they debriefed me there. Gave a complete. They are asking an awful lot of questions about what we'd seen with the Germans. They're particularly interested in one thing, that the Germans were using Red Cross vans to transport ammunition, firearms, and so on. That was one of the things they were interested in. And
could you give them any information about that?
Yes, I was able to. I had actually seen that.
So they were doing that?
Oh, yes, quite definitely.
Where had you seen it?
That was outside, it was on one of the roads outside Gohol. I'd been able to get a peep in from the fields.
Any other things that you remember from your debriefing that they were especially interested in?
Not really at the moment. I can't think they were interested in the state of the German troops. You know, were they the proud soldiers they'd been before, or how were they? And of course, you could see it was a debacle. There were instances also of Germans going down, pushing carts with spoil. They'd taken things from houses and loaded them up on things, and quite a few. Obviously, this was no longer a disciplined army in places. I should think this applied more to the ordinary Wehrmacht than the SS or some of the other fighting troops who were fighting rearguard action.
Whilst you were operating in France, had you come at all across the question of the different political allegiances of the resistance groups?
I tried. One of the things, I don't know that I'm correct in saying this, but I seem to remember that we were advised to keep out of internal politics. And I certainly, my attitude was, to hell with their politics. If they're resistance people, we've got to use them. Now, a very good example of this is this man Lulu. He was part of the Communist Party, but he was the one that really helped us. And later I was to discover that he was one of the greatest of the resistance leaders in Brittany. To give you an example, I was invited in July last year to go over to a little town south of Rennes to unveil a plaque to him. They all knew that the members of the CVR knew that I had been very close with Lulu after the war. I found him, I think it was in 1950s, and thereby lies another story. I was able to help him get on his feet again and all sorts of things until his death, and his wife and I are very close friends. I ring her and go and stay with them and so on. I would say that quite a lot of the sedentary people were not particularly in any group. They were just operating to the best of their abilities in enormously difficult circumstances. And so if they could pass information to which would help the Allies, or if they could derail a train at night or do something like that. I don't think that some of these smaller groups were necessarily politically motivated. But undoubtedly, the larger groups, I mean, you had the FFE, which is the Force Française de l'Intérieur, which was set up by de Gaulle, and then you had the, which was supposed to cover all the resistance groups in France, but the FTP ignored it and carried on, led to a lot of problems after the war between factions. But that's something that I don't wish to delve into.
Did you ever come across Breton nationalism there?
Oh, yes, the Bretons are very, very nationalistic. I even met people who felt that they should be cut off from the rest of France, and very proud people, hardworking, very likable people. Yes.
What was your next step after the debriefing?
After the debriefing, I proceeded to an embarkation point, and I had a little bit of difficulty in getting a pass for the French officer and the radio op. I don't know why, but it took some time, and eventually I got, I've even still got it here somewhere, I got the embarkation pass, and we were taken across in one of these troop carriers to England. And there we proceeded up to Baker Street, which was head office. And at head office, we sat down and wrote our formal reports. From there, I couldn't wait to proceed on leave. And whilst on leave, after a couple of weeks or so, I received a message saying that there were two choices left to me. I could either rejoin, because the Jeds were technically disbanded in France immediately after cessation activities. This was part of some deal that had gone on between SOE and MI5 and all this sort of setup. Obviously, I knew nothing about it at the time. And I received a message saying that I could either rejoin my regiment or could be seconded to Force 136, which was part of SOE in the Far East. I chose the latter.
Why was that?
Because I didn't want to go back into a regiment. And I felt that by now I was very much a Jed, and I felt that... I think also I felt that... there was a chance to... further, if you went further east, and I assumed at the time I would be used in Burma or somewhere, there was a chance to practice really what we'd been taught, and i.e. guerrilla warfare, in essence. And I went out on a troop ship, it took 27 days or so, with about 40 other members. We were the first party to go out of the Jeds, and we were continually referred to as Jeds within SOE setups, and landed in India and was taken down to, I think we landed in Bombay, and then we were taken down through to Ceylon. At the time it was called Ceylon, and there was a training camp there. It was just before Christmas, and we were given 2 weeks intensive jungle training, that was all. And there, I have to say that I have a lot of criticism. We were not told about the conditions of living in the jungle, merely how to get from A to B by cutting through dense jungle and so on. We were given certain basic advice, but we were not told about the diabolical insect life. We were not told about, given enough information that would have helped us medically. However, what I suppose they thought, that as we were highly trained people, we only needed the basic sort of information on the jungle. Well, they didn't give us all that much. And eventually, word came through, instructions came through for me to proceed to briefing in Calcutta. And they must have thought that they must have been very security minded, because they sent me and two or three others who were going on a different mission to Calcutta by naval ship. It was the Newcastle, a cruiser. And I was treated right royally on board ship. In fact, I always remember that the last night when we arrived at Calcutta, we weren't allowed off the ship because they hadn't made arrangements to collect us. And all the officers elected to stay on and have a party, which I thought was rather super. I won't go into the details of the party. From there, I was taken up to Calcutta and to where our camp was. And eventually, after a few days, I was taken to the briefing, which rather took me by surprise. I was to go in with, he was then a major and I was a captain, a Major Critchley, and a force known as Peacock Force, which had three majors, and they had their own native Experma rifles and such like. The briefing was quite extraordinary. We were to go in and we were to recruit levies from the villagers, send information back on Jap movements, establish dropping zones and such like. That was reasonable. But at the briefing, the Peacock Force started literally quibbling amongst themselves as to who was going to be overall leader.